Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 20th, 2004. Today's session number is BRM 2004-07. Today's speaker is Mark Brocker. The lesson for today is Bonhoeffer, Conspiracy and Imprisonment, A Spoke in the Wheel. Let's listen in.
My name's Mark Brocker, and the title for this session is A Spoke in the Wheel, and specifically we're going to take a look at Bonhoeffer's involvement in the conspiracy to assassinate Adolf Hitler. I want to look, give you a little bit of information, some of the basic facts about the conspiracy so we have a sense of what his role was. He was not the primary leader in the conspiracy, and so we don't want to magnify his role too much, but he did have an important role, and I want to suggest kind of the role that he had as part of military intelligence, and then also suggest it was another role he had as a kind of a guide, spiritual guide for the conspirators themselves. And so we'll bring that out. I'm impressed to see such a turnout. This is either delayed gratification or you're just plain interested in this title. with a meal starting now.
10 bed for dinner.
What's that?
Oh, I see.
Well, that was okay. I ate a peanut butter sandwich before I came, so that was a good idea.
It's as good as it gets to me.
Love the honesty of one of the cooks here. What I'd like to do is just talk briefly about a couple of key concepts in the Lutheran tradition. And I said yesterday that Bonhoeffer himself was both was part of the Union Church in his particular region. The regional church was a combination of Lutheran and Reformed tradition. And so we need to keep that in mind. But clearly he was influenced by the Lutheran tradition and Martin Luther. And that's important to keep in mind as we pursue the particular topic for today. Now, Lutherans like to emphasize justification by grace through faith, and then what's often called a theology of the cross. And this was drilled, maybe too strong a term, but maybe not, when I was growing up. I mean, if you went to a Lutheran church, you learned that you're justified by God's grace through faith in one way or another. It wasn't always said in those terms, but it certainly was instilled in us. And the whole importance of the cross was instilled in us. And then this would be manifested by an emphasis on personal salvation. And so in a funeral, you know, there's always that word, it's hard to go to a Lutheran funeral service without in some way being assured of our salvation and God's grace for us. Very strong. And the other formulation in terms of theology of the cross was that Jesus died for our sins. So that you just know that when you grow up in a Lutheran church. This was important, and I'm thankful for that, what was instilled in me and those key concepts. I want to suggest, though, that at times, I think, in our Lutheran tradition, when there's this kind of emphasis, that at times we can be a little slow to discern the political and ethical consequences of justification by grace through faith and of a theology of the cross. Doesn't mean we may not get there eventually, but it wasn't necessarily lifted up in a way, at least when I was growing up, that I remember all that much. I want to suggest that Bonhoeffer pushes the Lutheran tradition then, utilizing these key concepts on the political and ethical consequences that these entail. And I think this will help us have an understanding of where he's going when he finally gets involved in conspiracy. That's what I'm lifting up for us here. Just to highlight some of the things he had to say about justification, he described it, justification, as the event of God's self-revelation in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And it was through Jesus then that we experienced God's salvation. And Bonhoeffer took this utterly serious. This was the point of departure for his ethics. It all revolved around this primary event of justification, what God had done in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. This defined reality for him, and he made the point that this act of God's love then precedes our love of God and our love of others. To use another term, is sanctification. For him, Justification was what God has done in Christ. Sanctification is about the Holy Spirit working through us, and we respond in love toward God and toward others. For him, this meant that there could be no absolute loyalty to any human being. If this is the primary event, we cannot have absolute loyalty to any human being. It's why 2 days after Hitler came to power in 1933, he was on the radio warning against giving absolute loyalty to the Führer, or to the leader, the political leader. The primary ethical sin for him, given this primacy of justification, would be self-justification. Anything we do to justify ourselves, to, in a sense, make ourselves right in our own eyes and in the eyes of God and in the eyes of others. At the same time, he believed that this primary event that God had done for us freed us up then to be involved in politics and ethics. We do politics and ethics. That's what it means to be a human being. It's not about our salvation. In that sense, that salvation, the love of God is there for us. We don't have to worry about that. That should free us up then to engage in politics and ethics. In terms of theology of the cross, he stressed this is primary for him, the cross event, and so he focused on it. But he also made the point that we need to take into account the incarnation and the resurrection. It's the incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection. So you have to be careful not to just take one of those and make that the primary lens through which we do our theology, our Christology, our ethics, and our involvement in politics. Ethics for him is to seek to discern and do the will of God and to accept the consequences. You see, in terms of theology of the cross, we do what we do, we accept the consequences. That's the nature of life for us as human beings. It also means, this theology of the cross, that all historical situations are under the judgment of God. All historical situations. And he also then lifted up the theme of suffering solidarity, and was even lifting that up early on in the Nazi period. He was concerned about solidarity with the Jews. You know, the bulk of the church did not follow him in that particular concern, but that certainly becomes an even stronger theme for him during the time of the conspiracy, and then when he finally ends up in prison. And I'll have more to say on this notion of sharing in the sufferings of God on Thursday, so I'll say more about that then. Yesterday, if you happen to be here for the presentation, I talked about this essay he wrote on the church and the Jewish question in 1933, this again shortly after Hitler came to power. One concern there was this Aryan clause that said no one of Jewish descent could hold office in the state, and since pastors were paid by the state, this was a problem. In other words, anybody that could be a baptized Christian, but if you had Jewish descent, then you could no longer serve as a pastor in the church. So he takes on that particular Aryan clause in this. The other thing he talks about in there that is especially important for our discussion of the conspiracy is he says there are three possible actions of the church toward the state, and especially when the state, in a sense, is not fulfilling its proper responsibilities. One is to question whether the state is indeed fulfilling its responsibilities, so to call the state to account on that, not take over the role of the state, but to call it to account. A second is to aid the victims of state action. And certainly he's thinking of what's already happening to Jews and others and members of the church who ended up getting persecuted. And a third, he said, was to put a spoke in the wheel itself, and that's where I'm getting the theme for today when we focus on the conspiracy. He's thinking there of direct political action by the church. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be the extreme of conspiracy to assassinate a head of state. That's a very extreme form of this third action. It could be the kind of thing where, hitting the streets and protesting would be a form of direct political action. Could be lobbying is a form of direct political action. So there are various forms of this kind of thing. He would stress that the first two, calling the state to account, do your job, and the second, taking care of the victims, that's your focus. Direct political action is something you do if other things are not working for you. And certainly, the conspiracy, we could almost say, is almost like beyond even the third form there, what he gets involved in. But it still would be a form of direct, very extreme direct political action. What's interesting here in this particular essay is that he says even this direct political action That decision needs to be made by an evangelical council, you know, a council of church leaders. And certainly when he gets involved in a conspiracy, you don't call for a council meeting to do that. And that's why I'm saying he's in a sense, almost to a fourth option there. In terms of his involvement in the conspiracy then against Hitler, by the spring of 1939, there's a growing loss of confidence for him in the confessing church. He remains loyal to the confessing church, but he saw at least two serious failures of confessing church in 1938 in particular. One is they caved in on the oath of allegiance to Hitler. The confessing church is a group that actually took a pretty strong stand against the inroad of the Nazis into the church. So that's that group. But even amongst the confessing church, 85% of the pastors took an oath of allegiance to Hitler. And I don't think we should throw stones here, but just recognize the kind of pressures that were on these people. You know, this was their jobs, and there were a lot at stake here, and trying to find their way, and it doesn't look as clear when you're in the thick of it as it may in hindsight. But this was very disappointing to Bonhoeffer that there was so many ended up taking that oath of allegiance. He was also in particular concerned that there was no bold statement against Kristallnacht, which is when the Nazis and others went wild destroying Jewish synagogues and businesses. Bonhoeffer was really becoming more and more isolated even within the confessing church, and I think we need to keep that in mind. And I think he finally came to the conclusion, and you just have to kind of sense this, that he just didn't think the confessing church was going to find a way to resist strongly enough against the Nazis, and was really, really becoming quite disillusioned. In 1939, he came to the United States. Reinhold Niebuhr and others at Union Seminary, people that he had known when he was there in the early 30s, invited him to come there, and they were trying to protect him. They could figure out what was going on here, and they were trying to protect him. And in all likelihood, he came for about 6 weeks, was all he stayed for. And he probably could have stayed and had a long career as a theological professor. In one of our schools here, could have written a lot of books and so on. That certainly would have been feasible. Highly respected by Niebuhr and others. But he, after a short time here, he made a fateful decision to return to Germany. And I just want to read a short passage from a letter he wrote to Reinhold Niebuhr, and this is a very, very telling letter, and really ends up sealing his fate in terms of involvement in the conspiracy and then what eventually happens to him when he's killed by the Nazis. He says, "I've made a mistake in coming to America. I must live through this difficult period of our national history with the Christian people of Germany. I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. Christians in Germany will face the terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying our civilization. I know which of these alternatives I must choose, but I cannot make that choice in security." So he does indeed head back. It's hard to just say this is the moment when he was fully immersed in a conspiracy, but when he goes back, it's then or shortly thereafter where he really gets more and more involved. His brother-in-law was the, in a sense, kind of the mastermind of this particular group of conspirators, Hans von Doniani, and so Bonhoeffer had a particular connection in that way. The key leaders, though, in this conspiracy were leaders in the military intelligence office. So these are bigwigs. You needed a general, you know, these kind of people in order to make something, pull off something like this. And the military intelligence, often also referred to as the Abwehr in German. So if you hear that term, we're talking about the military intelligence office. Bonhoeffer's particular role was to serve as a courier, and, you know, take messages, and do this through ecumenical contacts he had, to send messages then to leaders of the Allies. And Bonhoeffer was still allowed to travel, and he would have ecumenical reasons because of his involvement with ecumenical church groups to go to Sweden, Switzerland, and so on. So that was his particular thing, and what the idea was, they wanted to find out if we're able to overthrow Hitler, Are you going to support us? Are you going to recognize us as the official government of Germany? And the response, it's quite interesting, the volume I'm editing, volume 16, which will come out next year, to see some of the interaction both with Bell, this Bishop Bell in England, who Bonhoeffer knew and was a key church leader that he was connected with, and Bonhoeffer, but then also Bell and this Anthony Eden in Britain, foreign minister. And Eden's response, basically, is no response. We're not going to commit ourselves to this group. Bell trusted Bonhoeffer, but they were not too trusting of anybody from Germany at that point. And so they just basically said no response, and kind of off the record, yes, we'd be glad if somebody's able to overthrow Hitler, but we're not making any commitment to any group in Germany. Simply was not prepared to give that level of trust to any group of German leaders. It's interesting that Bonhoeffer's finally arrested, not because of his involvement in the conspiracy, but he's arrested in 1943 because he also got involved in what's called Operation 7, which was an effort to free a group of, Christian Jews or Jewish Christians. And they got them into Switzerland, and there were some problems with the bookkeeping. And somebody along the way checked the books in the military intelligence office in Munich and saw some irregularities. And when they started unraveling this, Bonhoeffer and his brother Hans von Doniani were implicated in this. So he's initially arrested and put in prison in 43 for this, and there's, at that point, they're not aware of his involvement in the conspiracy. And so much of what goes on for the first number of months there, while he's in, even over a year, he's in prison, and the interrogations and so on, they're able to cover their tracks fairly well and keep the Nazis from finding out the full extent of his involvement of others in this conspiracy. It's really after July 20th, 1944, after that assassination attempt on Hitler, when that failed, and they also discovered some documents that Hans von Doniani had been collecting for years, documenting the atrocities of the Nazis and what they were up to, they discovered that, and some other papers, and things really unraveled after that. It became known that Bonhoeffer and Doniani and others were involved in this conspiracy. And it really, at that point, that basically sealed the fate of Bonhoeffer and the others. Although it would be April 9th, 1945 is when he and a number of others were hung. It's one of the last orders Hitler gave was to make sure that these conspirators were put to death. Now, in looking back at what happened here, Bonhoeffer is often lifted up as a Christian martyr. And that's actually quite a controversial topic. And I'm going to save the discussion of that for Friday. That's when I'll look at Bonhoeffer as a Christian martyr and raise that question and see to what extent that's an appropriate way to understand him. And I think we tend to look back on his involvement in the conspiracy against Hitler and view that positively. And even if we maybe have some reservations about somebody getting involved in trying to assassinate the head of state, I think we appreciate Bonhoeffer's courage and so on to try to do something about this horrendous evil. What's striking is that Bonhoeffer himself deliberately sought to avoid justifying his actions. And really said, they were involved in trying to murder somebody. In fact, they were committing treason. I mentioned this morning, I had a group here for this presentation, that it was just 5-6 years ago, the charge of treason was removed against Bonhoeffer in Germany, and apparently there was some people asking for this. I actually think that's a mistake, because I think he did commit treason, and that needs to be not tried to shove, make that less than it was. He did, in fact, commit treason. For Bonhoeffer, trying to justify this kind of action would be the height of ethical arrogance. And his friend Eberhard Bethge, who wrote the big biography that I read from here, said Bonhoeffer would have acknowledged that their response may have even been a tardy one, that they waited too long to act. And so to try to lift this up as a heroic action without looking at the full picture and the mistakes that may have been made would simply be an attempt to justify these actions. At the same time, you get a sense, and when you read his ethics, he can't say, well, now I'm involved in a conspiracy and so on. But if you read his ethics, he truly is trying to give an account of what would lead someone to that kind of extraordinary action. So an account is one thing, but justifying oneself is another thing, either before, during, or after. At any one of those points, that's simply not the focus to try to justify that action. Finally, God is the ultimate judge. He talks in ethics about failed attempts to seek ethical sanctuary. Failed attempts to seek ethical sanctuary. And I'm just going to lift up these briefly. He identifies six types or typologies here. One would be reasonable persons who naively think that reason can adequately resolve ethical conflict and shape ethical thinking and behavior. So just, you know, if we just think about it and reason together, we should be able to work this out. A second, he said, are moral fanatics who believe their single-minded principles qualify them to do battle with the powers of evil. Could even be a moral fanatic about peace. You know, peace is your principle, and that seems like a good thing, and it is, but you could become a moral fanatic about peace, and the problem is when you, if you just depend on reason or you depend on one principle like this, in a particular situation, especially an extraordinary situation, you simply may miss what God is calling you to do. It simply is not adequate to provide you with what you need in order to engage in action in that situation. A third is are persons of conscience, and they just get worn down by all the complexities and nuances of evil, and it's just that their consciences are so troubled that it makes it difficult for them to act. A fourth is dutiful persons who focus on doing their duty, but easily can be used by people in power for evil purposes, and certainly that was a major issue in Nazi Germany, and so many soldiers who got involved in some of the worst atrocities would say, well, we were doing our duty. We were following orders, and that was their rationale for what they did. And indeed, that's what they were doing, but you can see how even doing your duty, being obedient, can lead to destructive consequences. Here's a fifth category, a little harder to wrap. I've had trouble wrapping my head around this one, but he talks about a group who assert their complete freedom. They just are fearless in making decisions and almost pride themselves in being able to make the tough decision. And his concern there is, again, you may get so caught up in making your decision that it may again skew you from discerning what God is actually calling you to do in that time and place. And then there's a sixth group he calls virtuous persons, and these are those who seek to escape taking public stands, and then they seek refuge in a private virtuousness. So you kind of live your personal life, that's all in order, and then you feel good about that, and yet there may be a lot of other things that you're not paying attention to out there. And churches and communities, of course, can be guilty of this too. Can be very, very good within that kind of narrowly defined realm, but ignore things that are going on that need to be responded to. Who stands fast then? He says, those who stand fast, their final standard is not reason, principles, conscience, duty, freedom, or virtue. It's those who are ready to sacrifice all when called to obedient and responsible action. And that obedient and responsible action would be action that is in response, an attempt to discern God's will and to do it to the best of your ability. Now, Bonhoeffer talks in terms of responsible action, and his ethics is really, he doesn't come right out and say that here's ordinary and here's extraordinary, but I found these categories helpful to get at what he's talking about. There is ordinary responsible action. It's fulfilling our basic roles and responsibilities on a day-to-day basis. You know, things like family responsibilities, if you have them, work responsibilities, responsibilities as a citizen, responsibilities in the church, and there's this. Each of us has various roles and responsibilities, and so we fulfill those to the best of our ability, and it's important that we keep in mind, you know, we're responding to God and we're taking other people into account as we fulfill these responsibilities. And there's a concern that uses the phrase, God doesn't want us to be Hercules at the crossroads every minute of the day. Not every moment's a crisis. We need to just simply be able to live out our lives and fulfill these responsibilities. And hopefully they work together, and they may not always work together exactly right, but most of the time, when things are more ordinary, that's the way he approached things. And he, in writing his ethics, he's actually anticipating a time when it will not be such an extraordinary time in Germany. He's looking past, you know, the end of the war, what will it be like in Germany? And so he's trying to frame his ethics in thinking ahead. At the same time, he recognizes that there are moments where, and what he calls an extraordinary venture of responsibility is called for. Now, these are exceptional moments of crisis. They're very difficult to define. You know, is this an is this the time when I need to engage in an extraordinary venture of responsibility? What I've done here, and I want to do this briefly with you, is lay out a matrix of characteristics of an extraordinary venture of responsibility. So it's not just going to tell us for sure, because by definition it's extraordinary and you can never be precisely sure about it, but this matrix can help us in terms of discerning the character of an extraordinary venture of responsibility, and then we want to take those characteristics and take a brief look at Bonhoeffer's involvement in the conspiracy and see how that helps us understand what he was up to in the conspiracy. So, and I'll go through these 1 through 10. Our first one is the focus needs to be on God and others and not on ourselves. Just basic to what we're about in this kind of venture. Number two is there's no clear theological or biblical or ecclesiastical precedent for the action that's being taken. Number three, it's not justified by any law. No law you can appeal to that'll just let you know you're doing the right thing. It's performed, number four, without claim to self-justification. Number five, there's no claim to the ultimate knowledge of good and evil when you engage in this action. Simply don't have that kind of knowledge. Number six, a full range of ethical factors have been considered. Motives, consequences, the facts, situation, values, principles, all those things that are part of that kind of decision-making process. And put it another way, you've done your homework. You don't enter into this lightly. You really do your homework on this before you take such an extraordinary action. No one factor is made the governing law of the action either. So there's no law in a legal sense to appeal to, and there's no one factor, ethical factor, that can be made, this is the reason why I'm doing this. Number eight, the action may oppose ordinary responsibility. I even think Martin Luther King Jr. is a good example of this in a way, where he gets involved in the civil rights movement, and in a sense that's an extraordinary action that he took, a venture of responsibility, but his family paid a price for his involvement in that. His family was threatened, bombs were thrown at the house, affected his marriage with his wife. So that's often a characteristic of this kind of action. Bonhoeffer had an opportunity to get married in the 30s and made a conscious decision not to get married because he had, foreboding about what was to come for him and did not want to put a wife and potentially children through that with him. Number nine, other more ordinary options have been exhausted. So this is an option of last resort, we might say. And finally, 10, the judgment upon the action is entrusted to God. Then in terms of Bonhoeffer's involvement, I think if he'd have been a little more concerned about his own well-being, and maybe he could have even made a good argument for how this would serve God and others even a little more, he'd have stayed in the United States. That would have been the safest route for him, given what had already transpired. A second point is there was no precedent for a Lutheran pastor in Germany to be involved in this kind of action. No precedent. I think I mentioned, I don't know if it was yesterday, or I think it was yesterday, about this Delp, the Jesuit priest. I think you mentioned that at least Jesuits have this image of the warrior going to battle, and so even though Delp couldn't announce that he was involved in the conspiracy either, you have a little more of a rationale in the Jesuit tradition to understand his involvement there. But it just simply wasn't there for a Lutheran pastor to get involved in this kind of action. I don't think there'd be that kind of in our own situation. No, I mean, you just, that's not what you do when you're a pastor. You don't go out assassinating the head of state. Simply not their gun. And Republicans and Democrats alike would say that. No matter how much they don't like the person who might may be in office, it's not of their party. You just don't do that. Bonhoeffer was indeed breaking the law. Not only was there was no law to justify what he was doing, he was actually breaking the law and committed treason. There's no question here that he did that. Number four, Bonhoeffer himself argues that justification is something only God can do, so there was no sense of trying to justify his action. Number five, he talks about in an essay he wrote really to his fellow conspirators, and as I mentioned, I think in a way he became a spiritual guide for these conspirators, and these were not all practicing active Christians, but they looked to him for some guidance in terms of their involvement, because these are patriotic Germans at the very least, and you just don't get involved in that kind of thing if you're a patriotic German. So here, I just want to read a brief passage where he talks about there's no ground under our feet. One may ask whether there have ever before in human history been people with so little ground under their feet, people to whom every available alternative seemed equally intolerable, repugnant, and futile. Look beyond all these existing alternatives for the source of their strength so entirely in the past or in the future, and who yet, without being dreamers, were able to await the success of their cause so quietly and confidently. Or perhaps one should ask whether the responsible thinking people of any generation that stood at a turning point in history did not feel much as we do, simply because something new was emerging that could not be seen in the existing alternatives. So there's nothing to draw on, but he's still trying to encourage them that something's happening here, and we're part of this, and trying to say, stay the course. You know, even though we don't have a basis for this in our traditions, stay the course. Don't back down at this point. Be bold in the action. So you don't justify, and yet you're still going to be bold. So it's an interesting combination of humility and boldness at the same time. Bonhoeffer's involvement in this, as I think indicated, came after a long process of trying to deal with other avenues. In 1934, he actually considered going to India to study under Gandhi. He actually had an invitation from Gandhi to come and study, to explore nonviolent resistance as a possible way of resisting. I think by 1940, that time, that opportunity in his mind had passed, and he had very little hope of generating any kind of resistance of that magnitude. The seventh one, where no one factors made the governing law of action, just to illustrate this, if you, for example, were somebody that really was intent on telling the truth, it would be impossible to be involved in a conspiracy like this. I mean, he was lying and deceiving constantly to be a part of this. So if you have scruples like that, it can make it very difficult for a person to get involved in this kind of action. The danger always, of course, is when you start compromising your scruples and principles that you can lose your soul in the process. And he recognized that. He recognized the danger. You get such a habit of lying, such a habit of deception, that it can do something to you. I already mentioned it cost him an opportunity to get married, getting involved in this conspiracy. It also, he was not allowed to serve congregations. He actually was banned from public speaking. In the late 30s and then in the war years. That's why in our volume we only have one sermon translated. You know, normally we'd had more. And he never really had a long extended pastorate. Never had that opportunity, even before his involvement in the conspiracy. And then did not have the opportunity to teach in the United States, which would have been a normal role for him to be a professor, if not in Germany, then in another country like that. He had to give that up in order to be engaged in this conspiracy. Number nine, there's no other options to stop Hitler. I mean, that's what finally was perceived, and so it's time to put a spoke in the wheel, and he did so. Number 10, where I talked about the judgment upon the action is entrusted to God, you know, that's a hard one to analyze, but it's striking that in prison, Bonhoeffer if anything, his trust and faith in God increased. Now, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. This is a guy who struggled also in prison. But other people turned to him for guidance. And in a sense, he almost became like a pastor to many of the other prisoners and to the guards, to some of the guards in prison. So there is something about the way he handled the prison time that gives us a sense that he really did have a deep trust and faith in God, and that finally, you know, that was more important than, you know, justifying his action in any way. Some concluding remarks, and then we'll have a chance to discuss. One question would be, does Bonhoeffer resist beyond the limits that Luther envisioned? And Luther does lift up the right to resist, but he's particularly concerned when he does so about when the political leader is making it impossible for the church to fulfill its primary task of proclaiming the gospel and even carrying out, you know, the work the church does on behalf of the neighbor and so on. That's Luther's primary concern. I think to look at Bonhoeffer's situation, yes, he was concerned about what Luther talked about, resisting the state and when the ability of the church to be the church is being compromised. I think the Barman Declaration in 1934, the Confessing Church, really was taking a strong stand against the Nazis trying to run the church and making inroads into the church. Bonhoeffer supported that. But when he gets involved in conspiracy, he's gone beyond anything that is envisioned in anything I've read in Luther's writings. And he's really stepped beyond that. And I think it's a much more ambiguous kind of involvement at that point. I remember I had three Quaker students in a class I taught at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in the Graduate Theological Union who heard somewhat this same account that I'm giving you today. And they admired Bonhoeffer greatly. They admired him greatly, but still could not understand why he would become involved in an assassination attempt. That simply did not compute from them, from their tradition, peace tradition. Better in their mind to give a faithful witness and be killed for it than to get involved in something like this. It goes, I think we have to acknowledge that this goes beyond a church struggle at this point. And the church struggle was, as I said, the background for his involvement in the conspiracy. But in a sense, he's stepped beyond church struggle when he gets involved in this political conspiracy. A second concluding remark is that in extraordinary situations, we need to be willing to take extraordinary risks on behalf of God and others. That is the nature of an extraordinary situation. A word of caution on this is I think we need to be careful not to assume too quickly that we're in an extraordinary situation. In more ordinary situations, God may be more likely to call us to roll up our sleeves and go to work. And sometimes people inspired by Bonhoeffer, the rhetoric really gets raised quickly. And you know, it's like you're back fighting Hitler, and what's needed is, you know, letters written to your congressperson, action in the community, voting, being a citizen, those kinds of basic things. So I think we have to be careful. Sometimes we can step into a prophetic role when it's not what's called for. Another more ordinary role of being a citizen is called for. So I lift up the caution. It's really a caution about how we utilize Bonhoeffer's model or example too. Certainly we can learn a great deal from it. We can admire his courage and so on. But we've got to really be careful not to just let that model then, in some sense, govern how we're going to evaluate how we need to act. Again, that was an extraordinary situation. By definition, it does not provide precedent for any one of us in a particular time and place. Learn from it. It may even influence, it may inspire us, but you got to be very careful not to use it as a precedent. And then finally, Bonhoeffer's involvement in a conspiracy is a model of exercising responsibility in an extraordinary situation. But again, I want to just lift up one more time. It should not be a prescription for us today in terms of our action. Again, that's sense the hard work that he went through to arrive at the point that he did. We need to do our homework in our time and place, and certainly influence, but it's got to, by him and others, that we have encountered along the way, but it's the work we need to do, and we should not. Maybe the one thing we can learn from him is don't shirk what we need to do. Don't shirk the work we need to do in discerning what God's calling us to do in our time and place. All right, I want to open it up for questions, comments. It can be clarification questions, comments. We can go back and forth, however we go with this, and comment with one another.
He obviously worked hard getting to where he got. I was wondering, is there evidence, is it the genocide of the Jews situation that tipped him over? I mean, how far would he have worked within the system before he could take this extreme case? Because there was a lot of other things Hitler was doing too, but I'm just wondering if there's one tipping point that we know about.
I don't think you can just say there's one tipping point, although I've suggested that I think it's his disillusionment with the confessing church opens him up to this kind of radical, extreme option for him. The Jewish situation, that's obviously he's concerned about that, and he was, but the bulk of the exterminations happened, you know, after he had gotten involved in the conspiracy. So that in its, the enormity of that in itself was not the precipitating event, because bulk of those exterminations happened in 42, 43, and he's heavily involved in the conspiracy by that time. But certainly that's one concern. And I think, too, I want to lift up, Bonhoeffer was a patriotic German. And I think we don't want to lose sight of that. And I think there's a concern, obviously, as a person of faith. And then this is a guy who's watching his nation that he loves be destroyed by Hitler and others. And in that sense, he and his fellow conspirators, even those who were not, you know, what we would call active practicing Christians, some of these, were united in their love of Germany. And I don't think that should be underplayed at all. That's an important factor here. Along with, you know, finally for him, though, I think we have to lift up there is a theological basis where he truly is seeking to discern what God is calling him to do, even as he realizes he can't justify this. But his faith is heavily involved in all of this. It's just how he operated, who he was. Okay.
My question is somewhat similar. I think before any action, you have to size up the evil that is occurring. Mm-hmm. You have to somehow judge as to, well, just how bad is this? Mm-hmm. And of course, if you look at Hitler's government, there were, as my parents who lived through this, quick to say that there were a lot of good things that happened. The economy went, you know, came back. The nation was united to some extent.
The honor was restored, German honor.
Yeah. So there is this this conundrum of this conflict of seeing why things are happening, and which. Whenever we are in a dilemma, it's always like the case. I mean, when we look at Iraq, there are similar dilemmas. So my question is not altogether different in that sense. What exactly was it about Hitler that he said, now this is evil that we can no longer tolerate? Was it the build up to the war? Was it the Holocaust? Was it moral? Was it the turn of the German nation against moral living, or was it a moral thing about how people were losing their faith and now following a leader? Can you explain a little bit how he sized up the evil of Hitler?
Well, I go back. I think you've done quite well here on this, because I would say what the last thing you said in terms of Hitler, you know, I made the comment right at the beginning, the 2 days after Hitler comes to power, here's Bonhoeffer's 27, and he's warning about the danger of making an idol out of your political leader. I mean, that's what he's doing, and you have a racial identity as the primary identity, racial or cultural identity in terms of the Aryan race, that becomes your key identity. And here's Bonhoeffer, whose key identity, you know, as a Christian, is your child of God. So there's a theological issue. Politically, he's concerned. I mean, politically, the Bonhoeffer family would not have supported the Nazis apart from anything else either. I mean, they just, they looked at him as, how would you look at it as, you know, it reminds me a little bit of the way that the Afrikaners were viewed in South Africa by even the English-speaking people. Kind of like these, you know, rogues or something trying to run this. I think they viewed them as incompetent in a way, to simply not, they're not capable of leading the nation. And Bonhoeffer came from a upper-class family with a sense of, you know, there's a responsibility that goes along with being part of their class and a responsibility for the nation. And I think the Bonhoeffer family had that. Certainly a concern about the Jews, and not only the Jews, but others that were being persecuted, and church people being persecuted too. I think the Jewish question, though, for Bonhoeffer was, I don't want to minimize that, even though the worst of the exterminations hadn't happened. Because Karl Barth later on said, he was the one that recognized so early on that the Jewish question was front and center in this issue, and recognized, in fact, it was such a question, and I think I concluded here yesterday, was for him it finally became clear that if you reject the Jews, if you don't stand up for the Jews, it's as if you're rejecting Christ himself. And so he, Christologically, you know, he saw Christ in the Jews that are being persecuted. And so that's a powerful impulse for him too.
Just a background question. I've read just a little bit about him, but in what I read, it sounded like he came into the ministry without a strong calling. Can you talk a little bit about how he became a minister?
That's interesting. Let's say his entry was first through academic theology. Now, when he was 14, he announced to his family he was going to study theology. This is pretty precocious to do this. And interestingly enough, his family just said, oh, you know, that theology didn't qualify as one of those professions that would, so they kind of chuckled about it, and there's a statement his dad reflecting back on his life after, you know, after what's happened to him, said, and kind of something to the effect, and we thought that you would have a nice, easy life as a theologian or a pastor. And so his dad really changed his tune. His dad was the leading psychiatrist in Germany and had the leading position in Berlin. So this is the kind of family you're dealing with here. I think it was Klaus that ended up being the head of Lufthansa, you know, the airline. So this is a highly skilled and qualified family. But anyway, so he had 14, he has this, and he goes off to study theology, writes his dissertation, gets a PhD, what we'd call a PhD when he's 21. Then in Germany, this was the way you did it often. You'd get your PhD first, and then you'd do your ministry training. But something happens, he talks about along in the early 30s, so he's been to Union Seminary, you know, who knows, I think experiences with the African Americans in the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York may had an impact on him. But some, he talks about a change in him where he started reading the Bible in a new way. And he'll even say later he became a little bit suspicious of an academic approach to theology and that whole approach, and saw pastoral ministry, in a sense, grew into that in a way. And then this change in the way he read the Bible. And what he meant was he started reading the Bible more as God's message addressed to me in a personal way, almost. Now, I want to be careful here. He's all, still, you do theology, and I mean, and would be very critical of being the church without taking theology serious. So if another thing we can learn from Bonhoeffer is the importance of theology, Christology, careful thinking about God in terms of dealing then with the political and ethical issues one's time. So, you know, without a strong Christology, you don't recognize why the Jewish question is such an issue. See, that just doesn't come to you. You've got to have some way for you to identify why that's such an issue. So that's how he, in a sense, grows into it. He functioned. What's interesting is even though he didn't have a congregation that he served for a long period of time, basically 2 years is the longest period in England, but he does function as a pastor in a number of different roles, and even the seminarians that he had, I'll talk a little more about this tomorrow, but these seminarians, once they could no longer be in the seminary, because the seminary was completely shut down, he still continues to write what are called circular letters to these seminarians. Some are on the front lines, some are in churches, and to support them, and they're wonderful pastoral letters. And we've got a number of these in our volume, and it's one of the treasures that's in the volume we're working on, and to be able to share those with people will be, so I'm going to do a class next spring called Faith Under Fire for Adult Ed Class. We'll just look at a number of these letters, and I think people will be very moved by them and have their own faith strengthened and enriched by them. Other comments or questions?
How did he and the generals find one another?
Don Yanni is the key here. Juan Don Yanni, his brother-in-law. Because his brother-in-law actually was a lawyer by trade and was a minister in the Justice Department, so to speak, in the Nazi government, and then eventually moved into military intelligence. And Don Yanni is the one that would have recognized that Bonhoeffer's ecumenical contacts with church leaders outside of Germany could be of service to the conspiracy. And so that's really how they got connected up. He was a Bonhoeffer too. So you have you tend to know some of the key people when you're part of a family like that that's considered among the some of the elite leaders of a nation.
A history question: what was his position in German society before he left Germany and after he came back, and how did he obtain money to make a living and to travel with? Family money or the German state wouldn't pay him.
He did. The Confessing Church tried to find ways to use him. I mean, even after they put a ban on public speaking, they commissioned him to do a couple of, we're translating his theological position papers. This is in the early 40s now I'm talking about. But, I mean, he was running the seminary, and so he would have gotten some kind of a salary. But he had family money, too. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, this will be an interesting thing. One of the things he says, and I can't remember exactly where I saw this, but he made the comment once that he never wanted to be so poor that he had to economize. But I just read that and I said, well, he definitely was not middle class then. But that's, so there were sources, but it was erratic for him, but he seemed to get by and have money when he needed it, and he did get salary when he was doing various kinds of
What was his position early on when he got on the radio at age 27 and gave a message?
Oh, well, he was...
What kind of a radio was it? Local or national or... I want to give an address on the radio of the station.
I have never asked that specific question. No. But he was a professor in the early 30s. He was a lecturer, not a full professor, because the Germans have a very definite... you don't become a full professor overnight. It just doesn't happen
in the departments.
But he was lecturing at the University of Berlin and doing some lecturing then. And he also was, he did some, like a local church had him work with a confirmation class and so on. So he had work like that. And I'm trying to remember, I think it was an address, I'm just recalling my facts here, it was an address that was intended for a youth audience. Not that others couldn't listen to it, but so it may, and I don't remember the program itself, why he would have been on, but what's striking is that it's kind of the thing that Bonhoeffer is going to do, is to find a way to be on the radio 2 days after Hitler comes to power. I mean, it's just one who's, it seems to have a knack for seeing opportunities like that.
One last question then. Right now, we rever him, and we admire what he did in his life. At the time he was living, how did he react with the other church members? Was he sort of considered a troublemaker?
Yes, a brilliant
troublemaker.
Too radical.
Causing all kinds of problems for the church and the members of the church.
No, there was, after the Barman Declaration, there was the Dahlem Synod, where they gathered a meeting, and Bonhoeffer, he wasn't at it, but his buddies, so to speak, not buddies, but your other radicals, they were called Dahlemites, was kind of a term of, oh, there's those Dahlemites going, those radicals. And so he was definitely in the radical side of the Confessing Church, even. not just the, we're talking about the church that took a stand. Even he was considered a radical in that group, and yet he was respected. I mean, this guy, because when he took a stand, it was not, you know, it was done in an articulate way, carefully thought through, and I think what people would object to is he just wasn't sensitive enough to our situation and some of the compromises we may need to make, and so that was, he was viewed a little bit extreme, even very well respected though in ecumenical circles, like outside of Germany, very well received. In fact, the history of the reception of Bonhoeffer, in a way, in the United States, he's been over the years, has been better received here than he has been in Germany. And even after, I'm getting ahead of myself, but when we talk about Bonhoeffer's martyr, he was very controversial after the war. After they found out he was involved in the conspiracy, they dropped him from the prayer list. I mean, and that continued. It's not like all of a sudden right after the war, but he said, well, look what he did, and celebrated that.
You don't often want somebody that commits treason to be in your social group.
No, that's right. Question.
You put this in the framework of the confessing church. What is that?
In Germany, real roughly, there's Catholic Church is big and the Protestant Church is big. Both considered state churches in the sense. And within the Protestant Church, during the Nazi period, there was a group called the German Christians that were very supportive of the Nazis, or at least willing to work with the Nazis. Not everybody that was a so-called German Christian was a rabid Nazi supporter. I don't want to give that impression. But there was that group, and Hitler was trying to unite the Protestant churches. There were 28 regional churches. Unite them as one church. Easier to control if you can get them united and have your own, you know, the guy you want as bishop in there. So that's the goal. Then there's a large group, at least a third of the Protestant pastors, third to a half of the Protestant pastors became part of the confessing church. There was a declaration, Barman Declaration, where they took a strong stand against the inroads of the Nazis into the Protestant church and reaffirmed that Jesus Christ is the Lord of the church, very theological language, and that the church needs to reassert that authority. That group then is often referred to as confessing church. They weren't necessarily trying to start a church, but anybody that supported Barman and so on, then the Nazis started implementing various measures to make it difficult for you to function as a church. And I went through a lot of that, some of those things yesterday, but that's what I'm referring to. So there's the German Christians, and then there's the confessing church, the group that took this stand against the inroads of the Nazis. So the church that Bonhoeffer gets disillusioned with, though, finally, is the confessing church, the church that he's part of, that simply hasn't done enough, and he's lost confidence that anything of substance can be done through that church body.
What is the multi-volume work you spoke of?
Well, there's a 16-volume set of Bonhoeffer's works in German that was put together basically in the 80s. And then there's a new English edition being done, translating all those, that 16-volume set. Some of the translations are of previously published volumes, but have better translations and more editorial apparatus than that. A number of those are out, like Life Together is done, Discipleship, some of the more familiar Bonhoeffer volumes. And then there's 8 volumes that are previously published and now retranslated. That's part of this new edition. And then the second set of 8 volumes, it's done chronologically, following his career, basically from when he was an 18-year-old through when he's hung. And each of those is divided up into letters, kind of essay-type materials, and then sermons and devotional materials. And that's why I mentioned, we're doing volume 16, and it's 40 through 45. It's called Conspiracy and Imprisonment. That's the title of it. And we only have one sermon because of this ban on public speaking. So and there's a few little devotional materials in there. And then we have a number of essays in that, and so on. This is being published by Augsburg Fortress. Our goal is, we want some of these volumes in paperback so they're not so expensive. So, for example, Life Together will come out in paperback this fall from Augsburg Fortress, and it'll be $18 instead of $32. But that is the project that we've been working on. About seven volumes are done so far. Ethics will be the next one to come out, which will be a wonderful, completely redone. It's finally in the order it ought to be in. As I argued in my dissertation about that, this is the order it needs to be, so who knows? He never finished his ethics, so Betke and others have been trying to put it together for years. But now the theological section that lays out the foundations will be right at the beginning where it belongs, so that's glad to see that. And then the volume I'm working on shall be published next fall, so the fall of 2005. Got 5-6 months of work to do here, so I got to get back home and keep going on this. It's my barn chores I do every early each morning, because people ask, when do you do it? Well, it's my barn chores. I get up early and work on that. Any other, let's see. Well, time is last comment, question?
You had mentioned that Bonhoeffer was a member of the Union Church, and now he's a member of the Confessional Church. Did one church get melded into the other?
Good question. There were 28 regional churches. They were all Protestant, but it's a little tricky for us to understand the dynamics. But you have regional churches. Some were Lutheran regional churches. Some were Reformed. I think more were Lutheran than Reformed. And then there were some that were so-called union churches, because there was a union of certain Lutheran and Reformed churches back in the early part of the 19th century. And so his particular regional church, Berlin-Brandenburg, was one of those union churches. The confessing church, though, would be a number of churches that would, it gets tricky. Three of those regional churches stayed intact, and there were no confessing churches within those, but they tried to stay middle ground. Some of the churches within a regional church would become confessing churches. So it wasn't like a neat package, but you have a number of those Protestant churches then became part of the confessing church. And some leaders would be part of the confessing church and then maybe not be able to serve in their particular congregation anymore if the congregation wasn't going to be supportive of them. So that's tense. I mean, you think of sorting all the dynamics of that congregation by congregation. That's a tricky thing.
Is tonight's movie one that you think is a real good depiction of?
This is the best. This is the best documentary. It's the newest, and it's very well done. This is what I recommend. This is the one I'd recommend showing in your congregation. And then after that, you could show like the movie Agent of Grace, which is, you know, movie entertainment. But factually, this is the best account that's been put out. They do get the surrender of France wrong, but can't do everything right. So. They have it at 41 instead of 40. So
when is that movie?
That'll be at 8:30. And what we'll do is we'll show it. And if you just want to, it'll be done about 10 then. It's an hour and a half. And then what we'll do is, for those that want to stay, we'll kind of have a time for people to get out, you know, so if you don't want to stay, but we'll have a half-hour discussion for anybody that's interested in following up on that.
That'll be right here.
Be right here. So come early, bring your popcorn.